Hey. Hey, Dave.
What?
There's a lot of birds around, Dave.
Where are we?
Why, we're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
That explains the seagulls.
It does. It doesn't quite explain the samba or
the tango.
The tango.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sort of Mediterranean music. But it is Thursday at 4 o'clock, and you are listening to KKCR's Time Again, Once Again for Out of the Box.
You're listening to KKCR Honolulu, KAQA Kilauea, Kauai Community Radio. And Out of the Box is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the following underwriters.
Halehale Wellness Center, natural pain relief services, providing gentle chiropractic, acupuncture, therapeutic massage, nutritional wellness, electromagnetic cellular therapy, and spinal rehab. Most major health insurance plans and Medicare accepted. Open Monday through Friday, 332-5580 or online at kalaheochiropractic.com.
HawaiiGaga.com, Hawaii Vacation Rental Directory and Vacation Guide. A proud sponsor of Kauai Community Radio, Hawaii Gaga also publishes the Kauai GPS Tour Guide, an audio tour of Kauai for iPhones. More information online at HawaiiGaga.com.
Hale Halawai Ohana Ohanale presents May Day by the Bay in Hanalei at Waiole Beach Park Saturday, May 10th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Featuring live music performed by groups from throughout Hawaii. Also cultural demonstrations by local practitioners. A craft fair for Kauai-made products, local fresh foods. Displays of local nonprofits and a silent auction. Open to the public. That's May Day by the Bay, Saturday, May 10th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Waiole Beach Park in Hanalei. E kono mai!
Ke kare o Kauai nei, the sound of Kauai. KKCR's Spring Fun Drive starts Monday, May 5th. We invite you to join KKCR by becoming a Wave Rider. For a $150 donation, your business or organization message will be aired over 70 times during our 11-day membership drive. In addition to great exposure and supporting Kauai Community Radio, Wave Riders will also receive a 3-month link on KKCR's website. Wave Rider forms are available at kkcr.org or phone 826-7774. Get your message on the air and be part of the sound of Kauai. Ke kane o Kauai nei.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
That's right.
I like this music here.
Yeah, it's kind of pleasant. I hope that folks can hear it.
Yeah, I understand we're having some issues.
Yeah, we're having an issue at the 91.9 transmitter site up in Kahili. So if you're having a hard time hearing that, encourage you to listen to 92.7 on the north end of Lihue and Kapa'a, of course in Anahola and Moloa'a as well, and 90.9 on the north shore. And if you're out of range for that, there's always our streaming live worldwide audio at kkcr.org.
Okay, well, all that's out of the way. Let's get on with the show.
Yeah, right. Happy May Day.
Happy May Day, yeah.
Happy Lay Day.
Lay Day, if you're into that sort of thing.
Yeah, if you're into, you know.
You were telling me about Lay Day is not an official Hawaiian, like a traditional Hawaiian holiday.
In no way.
It was some set up by the Tourist Bureau or something like that back in the day.
I think it came out of Oahu in like the 20s or something like that. I'm pretty sure that every day in Hawaii was Lay Day.
Okay.
Back in the day.
All right. Well, I hope we have a good show lined up today.
I think so. I think we have more show than we can actually cram into 2 hours.
Yeah, hopefully it'll work out all right. We'll be talking about, let's see, what are we going to be talking about? Oh, we're talking to somebody about the Hula Festival.
Yeah, we're talking about the Merry Monarch Festival for folks out there who got to watch that, or if you wanted to and missed it, or if you did watch it and really didn't understand what you were looking at. We're going to be talking to Kumu Hulu about that, and she'll be able to walk us through what hula is all about, some of the history of hula, and where hula is going in the future. That should be very exciting.
Okay. Also, we're going to be talking with somebody about getting off the grid.
Yeah, that will be talking with Juan Wilson. He'll call in around 5:30, and we'll talk with him about his the happy conclusion of his six-year effort to pull the plug and cut the cord on KIUC. It's another house off the grid.
Okay. Let's see. I'm missing something. Oh.
Well, you know why that is, Dave.
What's that?
Because you've been sick, man. You're not 100%.
That's right. I'm running on about 2 cylinders out of 12.
Wow. 12, that's a lot of cylinders.
Yeah, normally I'm running on 12. Yeah, yeah. I got some sort of food poisoning or something. I'm not sure what it was, but...
some kind of bug.
Yesterday was not a fun day.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling better, and here's to hoping that that trend continues.
Yeah. Okay, well, before all that, we got some news items here. I'd like to read about this one study here that came out a couple of weeks ago. And according to this new study by researchers from Princeton and Northwestern universities, they find that America's government policies reflect the wishes of the rich and the powerful interest groups rather than the wishes of the majority of citizens.
Well, now, hold on a second, Dave.
So finally.
Isn't that what you and I have been saying for years?
We've been talking about
years?
This for years.
Yeah.
And now... scientists have proven that it is, in fact, the case.
Well, they have demonstrated a large body of data that supports that conclusion.
Right, yeah. So the researchers examined close to 1,800 U.S. policy changes in the years between 1981 and 2002. Then they compared these policy changes with the expressed preferences of the median American at the 50th percentile of income, with affluent Americans at the 90th percentile of income, and with the position of powerful interests and lobbying groups. Okay, I'm going to read through this. It's some of it's kind of technical, but it's very interesting.
All right, well,
you're into that sort of thing.
No, I love stuff like that. And if it's okay, I'll interrupt you and you say something interesting that I don't understand.
Sure, yeah, okay. The central point that emerges from our research is that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy.
So you're saying that the rich and powerful get their way?
Get their way with the U.S. government.
Okay.
While mass-based interest groups and average citizens have little or no independent influence.
So that's like the 99% of us. Okay.
We have no independent influence. Our results.
That's not making me happy.
No, it's supposed to be a democracy.
Well, it's supposed to be a democratic republic, but yeah.
Yeah. Our results provided substantial support for the theories of economic elite domination, but not for theories of majoritarian electoral democracy or majoritarian pluralism.
So that's what we call democracy.
Democracy, right, yeah.
Right.
It's what you expect.
Hope for, anyway.
Okay, this research explicitly brings the preferences of the affluent Americans into the analysis, along with the preferences of those lower in the income distribution.
So affluent, what does that mean?
Rich.
Okay.
It indicates that the apparent connection between public policy and the preferences of the average citizens may indeed be largely or entirely spurious.
So, okay, what does that mean?
It means you have no say in the government. So opinion has no merit with the U.S. government.
Well, maybe it has merit, but in the 2,000 pieces of legislation that they studied, it doesn't have any impact.
Right.
Okay. That's kind of frustrating to hear, Dave.
Yeah, it is. The research has found that government policy changes are correlated with the wishes of the wealthy and with interest groups, but not with the wishes of the average American, even though the whole idea of democracy is to ensure that the wishes of the majority tend to carry the day.
Now, it's for folks out there in Radioland, can't see you making little hand quotations when you say democracy. Yeah.
It's written on the page here, too. Okay, the study notes that the position of the median American and the position of the affluent Americans are often the same. Therefore, regular people tend to think that their political interests are being represented when they see the triumph of some political position that they agree with.
Right. So an example of that might be the idea that even though I'm not a rich person now, I might be a rich person one day. And if I were rich in the future, I wouldn't want my money to be taxed. So I would support no taxes on rich people, even though I'm not a rich person.
Yeah, that may not be a great example, but that it is probably in there. Okay, so in fact, they say that when your position is the same as that of the rich people, it's mere coincidence.
Okay.
So the average American will see their interests represented as long as the interests align with the interests of the wealthy.
So they're free to have their opinions, and their opinions will get acted on as long as they agree with the hyper wealthy people.
Yeah, if you agree with the rich people and you get your way in your opinion, then you think that the government's working for you. But in reality, it's just coincidence because you happen to have the same opinion as rich people on it.
Okay, so now how did they come to this conclusion?
Science.
I mean,
science and statistics.
They looked at 2,000 or 1,800 pieces of legislation.
Yeah, and then they looked, and I read this a minute ago.
I'm just trying to digest it all.
Oh, okay. And they,
because you're telling me democracy's dead in the United States.
I know the science stuff is kind of hard for some people to, understand, you know.
But why I'm asking questions.
Yeah, yeah. So they looked at these 1,800 policy changes, and they, and then they looked at, you know, who wanted these policy changes, or what is the opinion of, you know, the common person, you know, the low medium income American, and then what is the opinion or preference of the affluent, the wealthy, and their interest groups and corporations. And so, you know, in a large percentage of the time, the, you know, average American didn't get their way, while the corporations and the affluent people did. So the conclusion is
every time.
The conclusion is that the U.S. is an oligarchy.
Okay, well, so now let's back up a little bit on that. I thought in school they taught me that we lived in a democratic republic.
Yeah, or a representative
democracy.
Republic.
Yeah.
It's a republic. And it's represent. We elect people to go to Washington to make our policies for us.
Mm-hmm. But okay. But this study is suggesting that we don't actually live in a democratic republic. We live in
an oligarchy.
Okay, so oligarchy.
It's an oligarchy.
Oligarchy, that's a big word.
Right, it's a form of government that, you gave a good definition of this earlier.
Oh, yeah. Actually, the only reason I know is because I looked it up. And oligos is a Greek word for the few. And so an oligarchy, oligos and archy, that archy means rule by. So okay. Oligarchy is rule by the few.
Rule by a few. And in this case, the few are
the hyper wealthy,
the rich. And so ruled by the rich would be called a plutocracy. Right.
Right. Plutos being money or wealth.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's an oligarchy or a plutocracy, somewhere around that.
Or
so,
a plutocratic oligarchy.
Okay, there you go. So this, may not come to a surprise to a lot of people, I guess, because
if you've been listening to this show, yeah, you're pretty Akamai, and we've been talking about it for years.
There's a lot of examples of this over the years.
Sure. And America is not the first oligarchy in the world by any stretch of the imagination.
Right. It turns out that probably all governments of the world are oligarchies.
Well, many of them seem to trend towards that if you don't rein those interests in.
Right, yeah.
So what are the two main problems they talked about, the two main reasons why we have an oligarchy?
This study doesn't really give an interpretation of this, but there are ways that you can interpret this.
Well, I was looking for a specific answer because I read an interview with one of the lead authors of the study.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, why don't you... Yeah, that wasn't in the article that I read, so why don't you let us in on that?
I read an interview with one of the authors of the study from Princeton.
Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page.
Yeah,
two authors.
I'm not sure which one it was. Maybe it was Martin.
The two of them actually were on The Daily Show yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. I wonder if they talked about oligarchy there.
No, they were pretty academic about their take on
I don't hold for that. Because it's important stuff, and if you sort of dress it up in language that, you know, academies that only the academics are fluent in, then it's
right.
Like an important conversation that is held away from everyday people, so that's no good.
But their expertise is in that. So they have provided us a piece of information,
right?
You know, that they have gleaned through their scientific process. And
right.
It's up to us to interpret and to do something about it. It's not up to them.
Yeah, right.
So they weren't proposing any changes or anything.
I know, which sounds terrible to me because that would be the first thing I would do is propose changes to that, unless you liked it that way.
But do you want your policy changes coming from Princeton academics or from, you know, somebody else? I mean, so...
Well, here's the two things that one of the authors identified as the main problems to why we have an oligarchy. And the first one was the massive and distorting impact of finances in elections. We have no substantive electoral policy that keeps money out of the elections. That was the first problem.
We used to have that, but they've since fallen back. And now with the new McCutcheon versus U.S., the new it's kind of like the Citizens United Supreme Court decision.
They're moving the ball further down the field.
There's a new one that
That's
just
terrible.
Came out a couple of months ago.
Oh,
that,
no.
that took away even the modest limits that were on campaign donations set in the Citizens versus United one. Now they're all gone.
That doesn't sound good, Dave.
Yeah, it used to be that you could only write 28 checks of $20,000 each. You can only write a check for $20,000, but you can write 28 of them.
Hold on a second.
Now you can write as many as you want.
Well, you know, personally, that sounds like really cool to me, because before I couldn't write any checks for $20,000 because I don't have $20,000.
Now you can write more. You feel richer now.
I guess I do. the other example that was cited by the author of the study for why we have an oligarchy is because the two parties, the two major parties in our system, the Republicans and the Democrats, neither one of them are working towards the interests of labor. So there's no effective labor party in the U.S.
Right. So they, the parties end up to be
only for the few.
Well, yeah. There's
I never get invited to those parties.
No. And they become power brokers for the wealthy. So when a rich person wants to give his money to get his policies through government, you know, they've got to find somebody to give it to. You don't go to, you know, the court or the president. You go to the party, you know, and the party tells their representatives to vote for this or that.
Now, this is the black tie party or white tie party?
Democratic or Republican party.
Oh.
And so they get their... That's how they get it done. That's the mechanism. You give to the party tells their representatives or senators,
party members,
to vote a certain way to make these certain changes. And so,
we don't have to really flog a dead donkey or beat a dead elephant, I think, on this one too long.
But there's a couple of ramifications here. But we do have somebody on the phone who's anxious to get on the air.
All right, awesome. Let's hear from you, caller. What do you have to say? Welcome to Out of the Box.
Talking about economics, I just wanted to mention to you guys that the minimum wage fight has been concluded at the legislature here in Hawaii.
And what's the good news?
And a victory has happened, kind of a lukewarm in my opinion, but it's still one nevertheless.
Oh, good.
The minimum wage will be raised from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour. In 4 years, Hawaii is one of a handful of states that have passed it. The Congress in the Senate rejected it 54-42 to increase the minimum wage
at the federal level.
At the federal level, they failed to do that. But at the state level, we've increased it to $10.10 an hour. So you guys were talking about economics earlier and income inequality, things like that.
Sure.
So, there are forces throughout Hawaii that were organizing and lobbying at the legislature for this increase. Here on Kauai had a number of people that were involved in it as well. Unfortunately, it's going to take 4 years, but we're still going to be getting that increase. You know, I wish it was higher. Like at Seattle, they're going to be getting $15 an hour. And today actually is International Workers' Day.
Right,
workers
May
around
Day.
The world
Happy
fight,
May Day.
They hit to the streets to mention the concerns that people have in Seattle. They went on the streets to proclaim their fight for $15 an hour and on immigrant rights. In fact, May Day started in Chicago in 1886 over the eight-hour day. That's why we got the eight-hour day, because people went to the streets and they fought for it. 8 hours for the 8 hour day.
That's right. They refused to work.
People were working 12, 14 hours a day before.
They walked out of their jobs and refused to go back in until they had 8 hour day, and they got it.
And so, the fight for income inequality is beginning to spread across the United States, is beginning to pick up a little bit in Hawaii, and, Our legislature is a little bit more progressive, but it wasn't easy getting it. You know, it wasn't easy getting it, but we will be getting the 1010 and all, which was what Obama had pushed for nationally.
All right.
But he didn't get that done.
All right. Well, great. Thanks for the call. And this sounds like good news, even though we got to wait a little while. Is it going to just be an even steps between now and then? Or?
Well, you know, probably the raise the wage to Hawaii and the other forces that are involved are going to probably push for a cost of living increase, a rider with the minimum wage in a year or two. And we're talking about doing a fight on doing a living wage for at least $15 an hour.
Yeah, living wage. That's the next conversation.
Yeah, that is, and that's very, very important. You know, the living wage. Hawaii has one of the highest costs of living in the U.S. You know, but at the same time, you know, I think nationally it's going to be 15. That some people are beginning to push, especially at Walmart, places like them and Kmart, Walmart, the big box stores. You know.
Right. Well, my understanding is in Hawaii, where the cost of living is pretty high.
Yeah, I think from what I understand with the Department of Labor here in Hawaii, they were seeing over $21.
Yeah, somewhere between 20 and 25.
Yeah, but at the same time, that's going to be really hard to get. We had the big fight over 1010. You know, Sylvia Luke and Ige, who's running for governor, were holding back on the 10 cents, but Clayton, he really pushed them hard, and we had supported him to get that 10 cents because that's like $832 a year if you work 40 hours a week for a minimum wage.
Huh.
You know. So anyway, thanks for giving me the time. I wanted to mention this to your audience because you have a whole big show today with a lot of important issues, but this is one of the main ones. It's income inequality.
Well,
okay?
thank you so much for calling
thank
in
you.
On that.
Okay, bye-bye.
Aloha.
Okay, aloha. Okay, then, so we're talking a little bit now about the oligarchy, the fact that the U.S. is an oligarchy. It's official. The scientists have proven this. And so, you know, the first...
Congratulations, Dave.
The first step...
Because you said this before the data came in.
Yeah, you know, the first step in dealing with a problem is identifying that you've got one. So now...
No!
We know we have a problem here, and so maybe we can deal with it now. And you know... you know, kids are taught in school, you know, we're a democracy and all this. And you know, it's really not the case at all. And so we need to fess up to that. And also, you know, we need to get off our high horse that our government is any better than anybody else's. Now, we have some great documents. We have some great intentions from our founding fathers and mothers.
In America, you know, or the U.S., whatever, is number one, leading the world in many qualities.
Many equalities?
Well, I'm just in many, you know, many factors, many areas. For example, we have more people in prison per capita in the U.S. than anywhere else in the world. So in prison population,
we're number one.
We are number one.
Okay, so we need to stop telling everybody in the world that we are better than they are. You know, we are not. Our government is no more Democrat. And we need to also we need to stop pushing democracy, U.S.-style democracy, on the rest of the world and try and pretend we're spreading democracy around the world. Well, we're not. We're trying to spread oligarchy, our brand of oligarchy, rather than our brand of democracy.
When you say our, Dave, I get confused because I didn't think you were an oligarchic booster.
Well, evidently, I live in an oligarchic I got to get used to this. It's going to be part of the
allegorical oligarchy.
Right, yeah. So, you know, it's I live in an oligarchy. I said it. I can deal with it.
You feel better now?
I do. We've got a couple people that have been waiting here. Let's go.
Well, maybe they will give their two cents on how we might be able to spread democracy here at home.
Well, and if they had $100 million, then they might actually get it done.
Well, let's see what they have to say. Aloha, caller. You're on the air. Welcome to Out of the Box.
Hey, this is Gordon Levitz, and I'm calling in about oligarchy.
All right. Fantastic. Are you for or against oligarchy?
Well, it's not a good system, no. You know, when I was a little kid, we had a president. We had a really small government, but the president was a general. And
Eisenhower?
His name was Eisenhower.
Ike.
And when he quit office, he said, beware of the military-industrial complex. And I think that nobody listened to him at all. And we've got this oligarchy that is in control of this military-industrial complex, which is just run amok, and is really quite frankly, just spending money for profit and also trying to take over the world, trying to push around all the little countries and tell them what to do.
Seem like they're doing a pretty good job at it.
You know, the U.S. government's pretty effective at being the bully of the world. And
see, we're number one there, too.
Here we are in next month. We're going to have 24 countries come here in Hawaii and take bombs and missiles and airplanes and torpedoes and helicopters and just blow things up and explode things and kill animals and kill fish and pretend they're killing other humans. And it's all crazy, crazy stuff. It's called RIMPAC, Rim of the Pacific.
Yeah, that's not a very nice sounding name, RIMPAC. I can't imagine wanting to RIMPAC my friends.
it's something thanks for bringing up all this oligarchy stuff, because I think that the way social change is made is to shine light on all this stupidity and get people awake so that they say, hey, wait a minute, you know, is this a good system? Is this a good idea? I mean,
we haven't had
a naval war in 60 years. Why are we practicing naval war in Hawaii? I mean, what are we accomplishing? Why aren't we practicing peace? Why aren't we looking at ways to make world peace? It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're trying to do. Shed light on it here. Shine the light on the issue and get people thinking about it. All right. Hey, thanks for calling.
Yeah. All right, man.
All right.
Bye.
Yeah. RIMPAC. That's coming up.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to respond to a couple of issues you brought up. I don't think most folks realize that until 1932-33, when the Supreme Court said it was okay to have unions, that if your boss said you work 7 days a week, you know, X number of hours a day, and there was no sick leave or vacation, there were practically no rights at all. So it wasn't until unions were officially authorized by the Supreme Court that some of these benefits came into being.
This was under the Delano, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah, thank God. I mean, unfortunately, our current president is not really a Democrat. He's mostly like sort of a lukewarm Republican, plutocratic, oligarchic, Wall Street creation.
It's hard to talk about these things without, you know, these gigantic, complex words tumbling out of your mouth.
And another point, historical point comes to mind. I remember when, reading that, I think it was in 1851 that Senator Calhoun of, I believe it was South Carolina, got up in the Senate and said, well, wait a second, what are you bitching about slavery for? The Romans and the Greeks, they had slavery systems and they were some of the greatest civilizations ever. But unfortunately, I guess if the black folks were running the show, then he would not be saying that, obviously.
Yeah,
right?
Probably not.
So, anyway, thank you for your wonderful programs, as always. And the last point I would like to make, there's a website called duffelblog.com. It's a military folk website where the military folk can discuss things. And I came across a very interesting item. It said, and it was dated November 22nd, 2013, that Lee Harvey Oswald's name has been added to the CIA honor roll. Okay, on the wall, his name is now indicated.
And so why in the world would that be?
Yeah, and so the CIA spokesman said, well, it's been 50 years, and it's time to set the record straight, and then in 20 years, we're going to release the full, the full data. So, I find that curious. So I'm going to do more searching.
What was the name of that website again?
It's called Duffel Blog. Like Duffel Bag, Duffel Blog.
Okay.
Duffelblog.com. So, I mean, I had to read this several times. I printed it out, and I'm like, and I call this gentleman who has this, this Dr. Bruce, who has this
Sometimes you'll see him on the public access talking about the Kennedy assassination, so I mentioned to him about that. But, you know, I mean, each year it seems to me it's getting worse and worse and worse. The only great thing I must say, I've been in Hawaii Nay for 30 years, and God bless, it's a wonderful place, except for occasional racism and the traffic and other things. But the whole thing, the great thing I thought when I was working for a living, and thank God I'm retired now, is that when you worked at least 20 hours a week, at least they had to help you out with your medical and dental insurance. And in the mainland, up until recently, until Obamacare and maybe a couple states like California or whatever, you could work 100 hours a week and they wouldn't have to help you out at all. So that is the one great thing I really think that Hawaii, I call Hawaii the People's Republic. Because it is more progressive than most states, except for maybe Vermont or whatever.
I think we probably have more aloha than Vermont has.
Well, you know, the thing I find curious is that when they did a survey in terms of like how open people are, actually, you know, facts on the ground, Hawaii was rated about 24th or 25th in terms of openness. So I find that sort of like standing against the expectation or the hope of aloha. And I just tell myself, if someone else acts like a jerk, I should not act like a jerk. And so that's my operating principle.
Okay. Hey, we need to move on.
Okay, thanks
for the call. Aloha.
Bye-bye.
We are waiting for our scheduled caller to call in. But just to move on with this oligarch.
Well, I might be here right now.
Hello, caller.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
What's up, cuz? How you guys doing?
Good. How are you?
I don't know. You guys talking about money?
A little bit.
Well, this all this money, I got, you know what, I can tell you one thing. There's a lot of homeless on this island.
That's for sure.
And they're getting more and more. I've been trying to help give some people some food and stuff. And, but, you know, with all these monetary systems and all these, you know, but everybody is working, going crazy. I know. I see everybody rushing here, rushing there, rushing all over just to get this dollar bill for pay their bills.
Right, because bill's so high.
God, and everybody's sketching. They're like right on the bubble. It could go either way. If they got ill or there's like a family health problem or, you know, you can't make that payment, something happened, the transmission went down. But guys is just hurting. It's like they're right there close to being homeless, too, you know?
Well, the cost of living here is very, very high, and it makes it really difficult to get by even on one job if it's not getting decent pay. I was glad to hear a caller called in a few minutes ago saying that the minimum wage passed to be raised. So hopefully that will bring some relief to a lot of people at the bottom end of the economic ladder.
Yeah, help those guys out. And help all of us guys out.
For sure.
Because, you know, no matter what, you know, whatever it is, minimum wage and whatever, you know, about insurances, period. Everybody working so they can get health insurance. You no more health insurance, you either on a state or some other free one. And, right, it's just hard to keep things going, bro.
Yeah, it's close to the bone for a lot of people out there.
You know, so, I feel for a lot of people out there because, but times are getting hard and the taxes are going higher. All the permitting, the harbors, the parks, just to camp, hunting, fishing, everything is permitted now. Your car cannot have rust on them. You get cracked lens, they're turning you away for safety check.
Right.
You know, they're clamping down on every single little aspect all the way around.
Yeah, because the state wants more money.
Yeah, they're killing us. But anyway, I just wanted, you know, on another note, I did start planting some fruit trees, fruit coconut tree in my yard, and I'm starting to make a garden because I still listening to the haulea.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's all I can do is just look for that. And anyway, don't forget, help the homeless out.
Yeah, because it could be you, could be me.
Well, it could be anybody, you know, so you got to have compassion.
Yeah, I think compassion is really important. I try and learn how to be more compassionate. That's one of my goals.
You know, and sometimes they tell, hey, because you're enabling these guys to stay homeless. And then, hey, you know what? You can figure out whatever reason you get for not helping people, period. You know, and But that's just not how it works anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't seem, it seems like it's a dead end, you know, that all for one, only for yourself, I don't care about anybody else.
But it's the kind where you're going to eat the weak person.
Yeah, it's no good.
So, but anyway, you know, I thank you guys for the channel, and all I can say is, you know, help somebody today.
Good
okay,
words.
Bye-bye.
Wise words. Mahalo. So our next guest is going to be calling in a little while is Dr. Pualani Kanahele, and she'll be speaking to us about hula. Dr. Kanahele is of pure Hawaiian descent. She was born in Hawaiian homelands in Keaukaha in Waiakea, Na'aupua'a, in the district of Hilo over on the Big Island, Moku o Keawe. And she'll be speaking with us. I'm really looking forward to that. She's an accomplished writer, researcher, stage and film director, community leader, public speaker, educator, goes on and on. She's really, really very fortunate to be able to speak with her later in the show. And so I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, maybe so. Okay, while we're trying to get her on the air, I want to continue on with this oligarch situation here. Now, if we look at the, you know, doing a little research, who are the oligarchs? Now that we know that we live in an oligarchy, who are we dealing with? So, if you look at the richest people in the world, one, you can just look at the Forbes list, and I don't think it's comprehensive, but Bill Gates is supposedly the richest person in the world with $76 billion in assets. There's a gentleman in Mexico, Carlos Slim Helú, who has $72 billion in assets. And there's number three on the list, which is a surprise to me, Vladimir Putin at $70 billion.
That's a lot of money for a former KGB officer.
It is, you know, and how he came across that kind of money, I'm not sure. But then also a lot of the people that you might recognize, George Soros, the Waltons, the Koch brothers, Larry Ellison, Sheldon Adelson. So, you know, there are a lot of names you recognize. Now, there's a difference between just a billionaire and an oligarch. An oligarch would be one who uses their money to effect change in the government against the interests of the common person, of the average American. So if say somebody was a billionaire and they wanted to say that rich people shouldn't have to pay any taxes, and they go and they buy off a politician and they get that done, well, that's an oligarchy there. That's an oligarch. That's not using their money for improving democracy or the plight of the common person. They're just doing it for their own benefit. And so, Bill Gates, I don't know if he would be considered an oligarch. You know, I hear him out there, you know, with pushing GMOs on Africa and stuff like that. I don't know if he's really working for the common man, but, you know, he's not really working against a lot of people in this country. I don't know. Soros, obviously a very conservative, George Soros, he supports the Democrats. It's hard to tell, but he's more on the Democratic side anyway. And he uses a lot of his to effect regime change around the world. So he's definitely an oligarch. Now in Hawaii, look at the Hawaii connection to the billionaires. We've got a few around. Larry Ellison, he just bought a Hawaiian island. You know, he's worth, Ellison, $20 billion or something like that, I think we figured out. And I don't really hear about much of his politics, for that matter. Other billionaires, there's Oprah Winfrey. She's $1 billion. We got a couple more on this island here. One is Steve Case. He's a billionaire, barely a billionaire, I think 1.2, 1.4 billion, but he owns quite a bit of land here and on Maui. And then there's Pierre Omidyar. The name's been coming up here a bit lately. Pierre Omidyar, he's from Oahu, Punahou graduate. He's worth a few billion. but or no, eight to ten billion, something like that. And you know, he's the one behind the Hanalei Ridge Line project, and then the dairy also. But he's also kind of throwing his weight around politically as well. So we'll hopefully talk about that more in the upcoming shows. But we're going to move on to our next segment there.
Aloha, is this Dr. Pualani Kanahele?
This is I, Pualani Kanahele, yes.
Thank you so much for calling in. Folks just tuning in, we're speaking with Dr. Pualani Kanakaole Kanahele. She's a kumuhulu, very well-respected kumuhulu from Big Island of Hawaii, born and raised there, just in the district of Hilo, outside Hilo in Kaukaha. Thank you. Has been very, very active in the Hawaiian culture here. The hula master, accomplished writer, researcher, stage and film director, community leader, public speaker, educator, earning her PhD when she was in her 60s. She's now 77, and she's served as the president of the Edith Kanaka Ole Foundation and taught for almost 30 years in the university system at U of H in Hilo, Maui Community College, and is the former director of the Hawaiian Traditional Knowledge Research at the Hawaii Community College. Dr. Kanahele, we're very honored to have you today. Welcome to KKCR and Out of the Box.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I was watching the Merry Monarch Festival streaming online, and then I saw you came on after each performance and gave a little commentary about that. So I was really interested in what you had to say, and I thought that it would be really great if you could share some of your background and experience with our listener.
Okay, my function for Merry Monarch was to give small comments on the halau and how they were doing on stage, because the other two commentators, they have a script in front of them, so they say what the halau is going to do. And so my function is to tell them what they're doing. So it was a great night and great nights. There was three of them. Very late, but all in all, it was a great Merry Monarch.
So the Merry Monarch is 51 years now, has been going. But your introduction to hula started before there ever was a Merry Monarch Festival. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what it was like when you were keiki growing up and your introduction to hula.
I always seem to be in hula. My grandmother was kumu hula. And she learned in what we call a hula kapu style. So hula kapu style means that she's taken from when she was a baby and learned from a particular teacher, and they're dedicated to the gods until they get to a certain age, and then they go through ceremony, cut them free. And for the rest of her life, she taught hula besides other things. My mother was my second teacher in hula. And after my grandmother couldn't teach anymore, my mother was my second teacher, and also my oldest cousin on my mother's side of the family. So I've been in hula since I was, I don't know, I could walk, I guess, until 77 years old. So I've been in hula for 75 years.
Wow. How has hula...
Yeah, that is a while. That's... Goodness sakes.
Yeah, no, it's impressive. It's a lifetime of experience. How do you think in the world today, how has hula held true to its roots, and how has hula evolved?
You know, I give Merry Monarch Stage a lot of credit for the how hula evolved, because in order to get on that stage, you have to be somewhat well-known, and we had some new kumuhulas on stage at this time, which they allow new kumuhulas in, so they also can show what they, display what they have to, what they've learned. But I think for the last 51 years, if we take the Merry Monarch, for instance, hula has evolved so that Kona is not quite the same when I was a child, where everything was a little slower, and then on Oahu, everything was a little faster. A really good example of the evolution of hula was the Kumu Leina Ala Pavao Jardine from Kauai. And she did, in the Awana time, she did her the hulas that she learned from her kumu, which is Kule, Papunua. She's also from Kauai. She's a friend of mine. And her, when her girls got up to dance for Awana night, it was very, very fast, pu'ili and ipu dance, the kind of dance that they used to do in the 40s, the 50s, and part of the 60s. And then the hula became more defined. And so today, if we're looking at hula, we're looking at kumu hulas who are very aware of what that mele is saying and choreographing to that particular mele. And so that, and in Merrimana, they didn't only choreograph to the mele. They also used the kind of clothing that had to do with that mele, so they're emphasizing it a little further. Or using the kind of clothing that had to do with the island that they were dancing about.
So that the whole thing is like coming together, you know, the words, the movement, the dance, the garments, all working as one.
Together. And Merrimana has provided that because in the hula kaiko anyway, Merrimana has rules that you need to adhere to. And so all the kumulas that are going to get on stage at Merrimana usually abide by those rules. And that sort of keeps a sense of integrity to hula. And then the hula awana allows you a little bit more freedom.
So
you see the hula evolving, what hands used to look like, what different kind of hand motions are all different, which is, to me, is great. Hula needs to evolve.
So the kahiko is the older, more traditional style, and the...
Kahiko is the more formal, traditional style, yes.
Well, what pleased you the most about the Merry Monarch this year?
I think I was surprisingly pleased by the hula awanas they had this year. Because it was so, everything was so coordinated well for each of the groups that went on stage that it was, I think, and it was not only me, it was a lot of comments after that. That people who don't usually enjoy the hula awana because it's usually slow, et cetera, and it's the same emotions over and over. But the choreography this year was a little more innovative, and the dressing this year was a little bit more innovative. So I think I enjoyed the hula awana this year more than I've done in the past. Hula kahiko, of course, is always exciting because you have the drums and you have the ipus and you have the very, very hard rhythms that you hear all the time. So it keeps you excited. But hula awana this year was the best.
Well, also I saw at Merry Monarch this year there was halau from California and Japan. How do you feel about halau coming from different parts of the world?
Well, Japan, who... hula were on exhibition night, which is Wednesday night. And so they are allowed to come on stage on Wednesday night. They're not allowed to participate in the contest itself. The hulas from the mainland, California, and other parts of the mainland usually have a Hawaiian that's a kumu hula. And they're allowed to come home and participate. And I don't have any problems with them coming home to participate. I think it allows them to keep up with what's going on, and so they don't just always do the dances of the 40s.
Oh, yeah, because if you drift away from the culture, you sort of lose your connection to the...
Yeah, you do the dances or the songs that you did when you were home.
Right.
And so you sort of lost. This allows them to keep up with what's going on at home.
Yeah, that way it stays living rather than just being a memory.
Yes. That way you're not just preserving, but you're actively participating.
You spoke earlier about integrity in hula. Maybe you could explain that a little more.
I spoke about that in reference to the Hula Kahiko night and the rules that's Marimana Kaz. And the rules are maintained because the judges want to see certain kind of foot movements, certain kind of greenery that you're using, which we call kinolau. And kinolau are greenery of the forest that has to do with hula itself. And so not all greeneries have to do with hula, but certain kinds of greeneries of the forest has to do with hula. And so you need to wear those. And you also need to maintain certain foot movements. And so the judges are going to judge you by those kinds of things. And then the choreography that goes along with the words, they'll judge you for that. So that's kind of the integrity of the dance. But when it comes to hula awana, they can use different foot movements. And they have. Like jumping up in the air, that's not a Hawaiian foot movement. That's totally foreign.
Hmm.
Because Hawaiian dances are kind of earthbound.
Yeah, stay grounded, yeah?
They're grounded. And to jump up in the air is totally not cool about while doing Hawaiian dances. And so those are the kinds of things that I was talking about.
Well, hula is not new. People 1,000 years ago were doing hula. What do you see people in 1,000 years from now? Will hula still be with us?
I think, you know, if we maintain certain dances, I mean certain foot movements, I think the foot movements have to be maintained, the basic foot movements of hula. There's ami, and these things are reminded, we're reminded of these things through because of chants. Chants have this kind of information. And so we go back to the chants to find the information we need. And I think hula in the future... hula awana may look a little bit different, but I think hula kahiko will still maintain the basic step, the foot movements, some of the basic hand movements. The choreography is really depends on the kumu, but basic foot moves, basic body movements, and the fact that you need to be acquainted with the kinolaus, things of the forest that has to do with hula.
I understand from speaking with you earlier that there's a hula event coming up here on Kauai. Maybe you could tell us a little more about that.
Oh, yes. it's called Halawa Ola, and because Halawa Ola, the name comes from Kauai, and it has to do with the star of Peleani Iaka, when Iaka is sent to Kauai to fetch the lover of Pele. The lover of Pele's name is Lohiau, and his house is Halawa Ola. And from him came the drums, because that's how it attracted Pele. He had pa'u, and he had ka'eke'eke, the drums. And anyway, it's called Halawa Ola, and it was started on this island of Hawaii about four, I forget how many years ago. But this is the fourth Halawa Ola, and we have it every 4 years. So it started on this island, Hawaii, and then we went to the island of Maui, and then we went to the island of Oahu, and now we're on the island of Kauai. And each time we go to each of the islands, it's the kumuhula is usually from that island that will take over the conference, so that they can exhibit or display their dances and teach their dances from that particular island. So where Marimana is, displays halaus that are at the top of their, what is that saying? They need to be at the top of their...
Top of their game?
Yeah, top of the game, thank you. They need to be there at the top of their game. These are the guys that's going to Marimana. Halawa Ola is a kind of a teaching conference. So it's for the edification of hula. And whether you want to learn the philosophy of hula, whether you want to learn different hulas from different islands and different kumus, whether you want to learn how to chant, whether you want to learn how to make your own implements, all of those kinds of things, it's a learning conference. So that's what's going on that island. And Nathan Kalama is the chair of Halawa Ola this year on Kauai. And Kehau Kekua is the director. And so if there's anybody out there on Kauai that wants to get a hold of them, those are the people you get a hold of.
And this
find out more about Halawa Ola.
And this is going to be in the middle of July coming up.
Yes, I think between July 9th and 19th, or 10th and 19th, over there.
All right, well,
It should be good because it's on that island where they have a lot of hula. They have one of the original hula heiaus.
Yeah, up in Ke'e.
Island, on the north side of the island.
Yeah, Ke'e.
Ke'e. Ke'e. Ke'e and Haena is the name of the place.
Yeah.
And Ke'e in Hawaiian is also means where the sun is going into a sunset or it's coming out of a sunrise. It's that dome curve.
Huh.
And so it has to do with the sun, but Ke'e is that curve. So on the island of Kauai over there at Haena is when you see the sun when it is in the summer solstice. You can see it rise and you can see it set. And all of that is like in a K.
Well, thank you for
That's its relationship to that heiau. But that's also its relationship to the Pele clan.
And that's the clan that you have been brought up in.
That's the dances we've been brought up in, yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing your manao with us about hula. And
okay.
is there anything else you would want to share with someone who maybe has never seen hula before or only see it for the first time? And maybe what's the most important part of hula that you could convey to them so they could begin to understand what they're watching?
Well, there's a couple of things about hula. One is hula is really an individual thing. And, you know, I've thought long and hard about why there's so many hula halaus out in the world. They have some in Egypt and some in France and some in Holland. And, you know, it's just out there. And Japan, of course, there's millions of them. And Mexico. And so why do all these people, you know, why do they want to take hula? But I think that it's because hula is a very individual thing. It's a way of making you think about what you are and what your body can do. And makes you feel good when you get on when you get up to dance. So it's all about you, but it's about you and your relationship to what's out there. And I think hula does that one thing for you. The other thing that hula does is make you very aware of what your body is doing. So it forces you to think about what your hands are doing, the same time what your foot are doing. And a lot of people cannot do that. You know, to think about both hands going at the same time as both feet.
Sure, you got to be connected to do all that.
As well as focusing on something.
Yeah.
It does that as well. And so that's some of the things that hula can do. I think hula is beautiful.
Well, that's for sure.
It moves well.
Anybody can tell that.
Its movement has to do with the movement of nature, movement of the ocean, the movement of the wind on the trees. That's what hula is all about.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us, Dr. Pualani Kanahele. Really appreciate you taking the time to talk with Kauai like this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
All right. Aloha.
Aloha, Wiho.
Malama pono.
Okay. Well, that's pretty interesting. Well, it's 5 o'clock, and I need to get some announcements here for you. Oh, first off, there's a an accident on the Cujillo Highway near Kilauea town. I guess they are routing traffic around Pili Road and the Healthy Hut onto Colo Road. And so it's slowed down a little bit, but I think traffic is moving. So that's good. I'm not sure what happened there, but hope
drive slow, drive safe. Be patient.
Hope everyone's okay. Gets home safely.
Yeah. There's only one road, so if it's you got to slow down and wait, then just look out the window and enjoy the scenery.
KKCR, Hale, KAQA, Kilauea, K284, AL, Haleiwa.
Aya's Garden, all-natural garden and greenhouse supply. In Kapa'a, down Kukui Street from the Dragon Building. Fertilizers, amendments, soil, seeds, garden and farm organic growing supplies. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 822-7333 or visit Aya's Garden on Facebook.
Hale Halavai Ohana Ohanale presents May Day by the Bay in Hanale at Waiole Beach Park Saturday, May 10th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Featuring live music performed by groups from throughout Hawaii. Also, cultural demonstrations by local practitioners, a craft fair for Kauai-made products, local fresh foods, displays of local nonprofits, and a silent auction. Open to the public. That's May Day by the Bay, Saturday, May 10th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Waiole Beach Park in Hanalei. Eko no mai!
Neil Norman and the Hawaii Life Brokerage Ohana proudly supports GMO-free Kauai, agricultural biodiversity, and sustainable farming practices, such as community gardens, food forests, seed saving, and beekeeping. Malama aina.
Laser Bear proudly presents the 12th Annual Hawaii Rhythm and Blues Melee, a blues, roots, and jazz festival featuring guitar virtuosos Alvin Bishop, Duke Robillard, Little Charlie Beatty, and Tinsey Ellis. Thursday, May 15th at the Kauai Beach Resort, Jasmine Ballroom. Doors open at 5:30. Show starts at 6:30. That's the 12th Annual Hawaii Rhythm and Blues Melee with headliner Alvin Bishop and Duke Robillard with Little Charlie Beatty and their bands. Thursday, May 15th at the Kauai Beach Resort. Information and Gold Circle available at 808-896-4845 or online at laserbear.com. That's LAZARBEAR.com.
Joining us here on KKCR and Out of the Box, we've got the roaring Beltane fire in the background. And because it's May Day, it's Beltane, and we got someone's going to be calling in very soon to give us the update on Beltane fires. So we'll be standing by for that. Listen to the crackle and roar of the blaze. Yeah, so that was a little fire crackling noise. Hopefully Mr. Yah Caduce will be calling in shortly to give us an update of his Beltane experience and explain a little bit about what Beltane is. It's an ancient holiday every year on the 1st of May, May
Hello?
Day. Aloha, Yah.
Howdy.
Hey, howdy. Thanks for calling in.
Sure, sure. Thanks for talking about the significance of the day with Beltane. I appreciate that. It's nice to dance the maypole and do that.
Yeah, maybe you can explain to people what Beltane is and what a maypole's all about.
Okay, well, Beltane is the midway point between spring equinox and summer solstice, and it's the exact opposite of Halloween, which is between the fall equinox and the winter solstice. They're exactly opposite each other, and they represent kind of opposite of each other. Like, so the seeds have been planted already, but what Beltane signifies is the sprouting. So now the seeds have sprouted. And the maypole is these ribbons that are tied to the top of a pole, and people grab a ribbon and pull it out as far as it goes, and then they weave in and out of each other once one circle goes one way and one goes the other way. And
like a big dance, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And through that process of holding the ribbons, it creates this wonderful weave on this pole, and what those are your kind of hopes and dreams and intentions for this season. And those are then woven into this pole to stand and throughout the season. So your intentions and prayers are right there. So
that sounds kind of nice, and it sounds like it's appropriate for spring and renewal and birth and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. It signifies that sprouting.
Fecundity and fertility.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. So how are you going to be celebrating Beltane this year?
Oh, we're having some folks over, and we're going to dance the maypole. We've got a pole, a piece of bamboo with flowers on top, and 22 ribbons stretched out. And we'll try to find 22 folks to take a ribbon, and we'll weave our prayers this summer.
Is 22 a special number, or is that just the number of ribbons you have?
I think that's the number of ribbons I have.
Oh, that's perfect then.
Yeah, exactly. But 22 is a nice power number as well.
Sure.
Yeah, and then, you know, the fires afterwards, Beltane has always had fires. The significance to me, I don't know, and I just asked the Cosmic Mama, and she wasn't sure either, but the fires have always represented it. Maybe because you dance the pole at, it's at sundown, so.
Oh, because then it gets dark and it gets cooler and it's nice to have a fire.
Yeah, exactly. So. Huh. That's how we're going to do it. We'll probably blow the conch, which is always exciting to kick it off. So, yeah, right on.
Well, thank you so much for calling in with that report from the field.
Sure, thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity, and happy Beltane to you folks.
Well, thank you, and happy Beltane as well to you and your family.
Thanks. Take care.
Aloha.
Bye.
That was Yah Caduce, one of the co-hosts of the Homegrown Garden Island Bluegrass Show. Which is Tuesdays, I think, from 1 to 3 or thereabouts.
2 to 4, I believe.
Okay, it's somewhere in there.
Yeah, right before Felicia's show.
Right,
Tuesday.
The Kauai Soapbox.
Yeah, and also, as one of our callers earlier mentioned, it is International Workers' Day, and it's celebrated throughout the world, pretty much everywhere except the U.S.,
because we don't celebrate workers in
the U.S.
Even
though it started in the U.S.
Huh.
I think it started in 1886, where the National Convention of the Federation of Trades and Labor Union proclaimed that eight hours shall constitute a legal day's labor. And it was to take place May 1st, 1886. And when the time came around, 300,000 workers in Chicago left their jobs, refused to go back.
After the 8 hours that they'd worked.
I don't know. Maybe they walked out at the beginning of the day. I'm not sure. And
300,000?
300,000.
That's a lot. That's a lot of people.
In Chicago, you know, in 1884. And so, but it didn't, the national 8-hour day didn't start then, but the battle for it did. And after many skirmishes, it became the national legal day of labor. So, yeah, that's and also, I mean, it's kind of associated with communist socialist countries or something like that. You know, Russia used to have their big May Day parade where they parade their missiles down the Kremlin, whatever.
You know,
a
lot of things seemed to go sour in the 20th century. Stuff got really polarized. A lot of people were yelling at each other, building missiles. I don't think it turned out well.
Right, yeah. Are we improving, though? That's the question.
Well, every day is a new opportunity to stop doing the stupid stuff.
Well, but it still keeps happening, though, for some reason. But I have to think, hope that people are awakening to the situation, and maybe by our bringing the news out to them, they can start to imagine a better world.
Well, hope springs eternal, I've heard. And I certainly make efforts to remain hopeful in my life and to not get too bogged down with too much negativity and to keep my eyes on the prize and stay upbeat and engage and, you know, work towards what seems like will improve things and be respectful, listen to others, try to be compassionate. We were talking about that earlier. And I'm very hopeful on the whole because I think things are going to turn out okay.
I think so too. One thing that I find encouraging is, you know, no World War III yet. I mean, even though it seems to be a lot of people working toward a big world war, and even the Ukraine is the latest battle in that war there. But nobody seems to be interested in that. Even though, you know, there's a lot of people pushing for it. Hey, we got to have this war here in Iran or Syria or North Korea or wherever. You know, it just doesn't seem to be taking hold anymore. Nobody seems to be enthusiastic about the big world war anymore. So,
well, I don't know how enthusiastic most people in the world have ever been about gigantic cataclysms. But here's an interesting thing that happened in the news last week. And this is coming out of a little tiny island group in the Western Pacific called the Marshall Islands. Have you ever heard of those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of a Bikini and Aniwatok?
At all.
Yeah. Well, this is a place where the U.S., in their might and wisdom, unleashed a barrage of nuclear testing starting in 1946 after World War II and the nuking of Japan. You know, once or twice wasn't enough. They had these new weapons. They had trying to figure out what to do with them. So they went to what they thought was the middle of nowhere, the Marshall Islands, and they took over several of the atolls there and kicked the people out, the Marshall Islanders, and then proceeded to do their nuclear testing throughout the 50s and then their missile testing throughout the 60s and 70s and then their global positioning system, their satellite control networks, even to this day. And in fact, here on Kauai, we have a special relationship with those islands in the Marshall Islands, Kwajalein Atoll, another atoll there, low-lying island with a large central lagoon. To this day, we practice shooting missiles from Kauai to Kwajalein Atoll to see how accurate they can be. Well, most people are somewhat aware that there's been a lot of nuclear missile testing and nuclear bomb testing in the 20th century. But here's the good news. The good news is that the Marshall Islanders took some of their money and they got compensation, a small amount of compensation from the U.S. for blowing up their islands. And they hired a super high-powered legal team. And these lawyers have been going over international law, and they have just released a lawsuit in the International Claims Court, and also suing Obama and the present leaders of the U.S., as well as the 9 nuclear powers in the world, the former Soviet Union, Russia, the U.S., France, the U.K. Israel is on that list, even though they haven't admitted that they have nuclear bombs or not, India, Pakistan, the 9 nations that everybody knows have nuclear power, nuclear weapons. And the Marshall Islands are suing these nuclear powers for failure to adhere to the international obligations that they all agreed to in 1968 with the express intention to work diligently and earnestly towards the elimination of nuclear weapons. So I'm pretty happy to see the Marshall Islanders pressing forward on this point for peace. It's more people need to jump on that bandwagon, and they're not doing it out of a sense that there's no like financial aspect of it. They're not trying to get money for doing this. They're just pointing out that they know better than many people in the world how terrible it is to have nuclear bombs go off in your backyard.
So, no, I wasn't aware that it was part of the nuclear nonproliferation treaty that atomic weapons would be dismantled or eliminated at some point in the future.
Yeah, they agreed to do that.
Yeah, okay. I thought it was that it wouldn't spread to other countries. I think that's the major element we hear about.
That's what you hear about all the time. Right. But what you don't hear about is working towards the systematic elimination of nuclear weapons.
Right.
And, you know, the U.S. still has claims first strike capacity, and, you know, that's part of their mutual assured destruction, their global nuclear strategy.
Yeah, we have even recently threatened the use of nuclear weapons against Iran.
Yeah, the quote being, nothing's off the table.
Yeah,
all options will be considered.
Which means we have nukes and we will use them.
And we will use them, yeah.
Yeah, which is the exact definition of terrorism, nuclear terrorism.
Yeah,
for that matter,
threatening to nuke somebody, that seems like terroristic threatening.
Yeah, I mean, what are the people of Iran supposed to think? You're like, oh, we better hide under our desks here.
Well, I think, you know, when the U.S. threatens to nuke somebody, they have some credibility there because the U.S. is the only nation on the planet that has ever nuked anybody in times of war.
Yeah, and the Marshall Islands were the location of 67 tests, nuclear tests.
67. All of them.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot. And
how many on U.S. soil?
The U.S. has had...
On the mainland.
The U.S. has conducted over 1,000 nuclear tests.
Overall,
yeah.
How many in, like, the nuclear test site in Nevada?
You mean the Navajo lands?
Yeah, near Las Vegas. You know, the big nuclear test site.
Hundreds.
Hundreds.
Literally hundreds.
There's a little video you can watch on the internet there that shows all of the nuclear detonations on the world. And it's like a map of the world and then a timeline that goes along, and then you'll just see a
little
flash.
Like a little popcorn.
Yeah, you see a flash in one, then a flash in another, and then and then a whole bunch of them will go off in 1 year and everything. And then to realize what's going on with each one of those flashes.
Yeah, each little flash of light is not just pixels on a screen. Perhaps you're familiar with some of the horrific devastation that was inflicted on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Some of the photographs of what one little tiny nuclear bomb can do to a city.
Yeah, and that was small in relative terms.
Yeah, those were like 15 or 20 kilotons. One of the blasts that they shot off in Bikini Atoll, the Bravo shot, that was 15 megatons, which means it was 1,000 times more powerful than Hiroshima or Nagasaki.
So that was a hydrogen bomb?
Yeah, one of the first hydrogen bombs. And, you know, they didn't know, the U.S. military planners had no idea how powerful a bomb was going to be. They wound up irradiating and spreading fallout over the whole archipelago. And even a Japanese fishing ship that was, you know, not as close as they thought it was going to be. The blast was so much bigger than they imagined it was going to be. It rained nuclear radioactive fallout in the whole region. And it's you can see maps of where radioactivity was detected after that. And it's kind of shocking. It's like the entire Western Pacific.
Hmm. I know some people that worked at Kwajalein. And, there's another... Johnston Atoll.
Johnston Atoll, yeah.
Another one there. There were two nuclear accidents there.
Yeah.
Plane crashed on takeoff there. It was going to send a a missile up to for an atmospheric test, and it crashed on the runway and spread plutonium or uranium all over the place. So they just bulldozed it into the ocean.
Oh, that's a great. Yeah.
And there was another one. A missile was going off, exploded on the launch pad, and spread contamination all over. Yeah, the nuclear legacy there is not very good there. Now, when was the last nuclear blast on the Earth? Now,
I'm guessing it was back in 96.
Well, let's see. Was that the French one in the South Pacific?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure.
Yeah, the French did one in the 90s.
Oh, no, the French did hundreds of tests.
Well, I mean, just recently, and this was not too long ago. But then, you know, supposedly North Korea detonated one a few years ago, but there's been no confirmation of that. There was some. It could have been a conventional bomb that they were able to pick it up on seismographs, but they said it was a test of their nuclear capabilities. But there's been no confirmation of that. But so I think the longer we go before the last one or since the last one, then
the better we are.
The better off we are.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, and kudos to the Marshall Islanders for actually compelling the great powers of the world to put some money where their mouths are. And actually step off the dime and begin to dismantle our atomic arsenal.
Yeah. Now there's a lot fewer of these on the planet now than there used to be. I mean, the U.S. used to have like 17,000 of them. Now we're down to 2,000 or something like that.
I think it's more than that, but there's fewer than it used to be because the ones that we have now are so much boomier. So they didn't need to have
as many to blow up the whole planet as they used to, the small ones.
Right. So I don't know if that's actually a big step in the right direction.
Oh, so the capability is less, but the number of them, or the capability is the same, but the number
or greater.
Well, I hope they never get used again. But it would be nice to get rid of them. Even just having them around is dangerous. I wouldn't want to. Now we live.
Can you hug your child with nuclear arms?
There's a bunch in Hawaii, I would assume. They never tell you where they are, but there's a bunch in Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, and I'm sure they have nuclear capacity there.
We've had callers that say they're on Kauai, but I seriously doubt that. There's no reason for them to be here. They don't have the security for it, for that matter. They're not going to have them out there unless they have an army to protect them.
Yeah, well, I don't know. But just to emphasize the positive, stay positive on this. Kudos to the Marshall Islanders for pressing forward to get the major powers to honor their commitments. And wouldn't it be nice to one day not have any nuclear weapons on the planet?
You're talking about weather.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. This is Juan Wolf. I'm supposed to call in around 5:30 for Jonathan.
Oh, yeah. You're early, but that's fine.
Yeah, early is good. You're often early, Juan.
That's my father's middle name.
Early?
Juan Early Wilson.
Wow.
It has nothing to do with me in particular, but it was his name.
Huh. Well, you know, you came from him. I mean, he's your father, so.
Yeah, so do you want me to call back in 5 minutes?
No. Got you on the phone now. I guess it'd take a moment to introduce our topic here.
Yeah.
The reason why I invited you to call into the show today is because my understanding is you spent the last 6 years steadfastly, one solar panel at a time, one battery at a time, turning one appliance off at a time, trying to get your power consumption down and your ability to generate electricity yourself up to the point where today you have been able to cut the cord to KIUC.
That is correct, but it's a little bit accurate in this sense, and that is that I really haven't tamed my appetite.
Oh, really?
No. If I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning and wandered through my house to the refrigerator, I'd pass the little blue and green blinking lights, the little red pilot lights of chargers and machines that were just chewing away, usually recharging batteries on digital equipment or whatever. I never thought twice about those things. And now I do.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, it's like
when you have to make the power, suddenly it matters a lot more.
Now it matters a lot more.
Yeah.
And it was a rather sudden transformation. It was, I tried to ease my way, like putting your toe in the water, you know, is the water cold? Well, I get adjusted, my toe will get adjusted. And eventually you wade in up to your private parts, and then you really have to sort of deal with reality.
Yeah, man up.
Yeah, right, exactly. up or down? Are we going in the water or not?
Yeah. Well, so how's the water?
The water's fine. It doesn't feel too different in temperature than before, other than a few specific details.
Tell us what you're learning.
What I'm learning is that the guy that did the wiring in my house in 1980 when he built this house,
yeah,
kind of didn't know what he was doing.
Huh.
So when he did three-way switches, none of them worked. You know, like the hall light at one end of the corridor and the other, like you turn one on and you turn the other off to go to bed. None of that stuff worked. He also didn't understand other things like grounding and a few other details of like wiring a house.
Huh.
So when my brand new ground fault sensitive system cranks up and I go and turn on the big old toaster oven or the big old microwave, it waits about 10 seconds. It looks at what's going on and says, ground fault, I'm out of here. So I had to get down to a regular toaster and a smaller microwave at lower power settings.
So you had to power down a little bit.
I had to power down. But I think what I really have to do now probably is rewire that load center so that it's properly wired and there's not a ground fault in it. Because there wasn't even ground fault switches in bathrooms and kitchens and outdoor locations when they built this house. And this system is sensitive to any errant currents that don't find proper grounding.
Hmm. I don't know what that means, but I will ask you, how many solar panels do you have on your roof?
That are working or that are in, say, in chain, you know, okay. I've got six systems on my roof. And the earliest ones are doing not yeoman's work, but just sort of junior work. Like I've got one system with two panels that's just doing my bathroom and master bedroom lighting so I can stumble from one place to another in the middle of the night, even if everything else is down. And
you don't have a headlamp?
Yeah, I've got a headlamp, but if I just want to turn on the light next to the bed and move to the bathroom and turn on the light there and like put the antibiotic on the puncture wound, I can do it without the headlamp. So
you haven't really changed your lifestyle very much other than getting a smaller toaster.
No, a smaller toaster and a smaller microwave, yes. Well, no, the biggest difference is this, and that is if you're running on KIUC power,
uh-huh,
it's very much like having a motorboat with a full tank of gasoline, where you get in it, you turn the ignition on, the lights flicker into life, you turn on the engine, you get the two Mercury 100 horsepower engines charging away, and you drive the thing away like a car. You don't care about the wind, you don't care about the oncoming weather, you don't care about the waves, you just power through them.
Okay, so with KIC, you can,
it's like
you don't have to care.
A boat.
You don't have to care.
That's a power boat. But being on your own power, it's like you're sailing a boat, and you're looking at the waves, and you're looking at the sun, and you're looking at the clouds, and you're monitoring every little thing that's going on all day long on everything that's running, and saying, should I turn that off? Oh, maybe I should just let these batteries sit for a while and charge, or maybe I should do this over here. But it's much closer to the ground, if you know what I mean.
Well, it sounds like it's forced you to bring your awareness to a higher level.
Well, yes, well, because you're the power company now. You are KIUC. You know what I mean? It's like you're sitting in the station at the power plant saying, there's a big heavy load coming. I better turn something off here and turn something on there.
So, Juan, do you have just solar? Do you have any wind power?
No, I don't have any wind. I have, as I say, seven solar systems operating right now.
And they're all separate from each other.
They're all separate from each other. One of them, it has no batteries at all, and that's just four 50-watt panels that run a DC pump that goes to a 14-foot deep well that pumps water into my garden. Because I live on the west side, and without that pump, I'd be paying an extra $100 or $150 a month to the water department for providing water to my garden.
So you have not just energy independence now, but you have some of your own water infrastructure.
To a degree, yeah. I also have a rainwater system off the roof that has a solar panel that collects the water on that roof into a 1,000-gallon tank.
Hmm. So what motivated you to pursue this path?
The collapse of Western civilization that started in about 2005 or 6 and peaked in people's interest, at least, in 2007 and 8. And is ongoing. That's
so, I know this is something that you've been interested in following for quite some time, but what finally got you off the dime and made you decide, okay, I got to get serious about this?
Well, I think two early experiences in my life prepared me in a way. And one of them was that when I was born, my grandparents had a place in upstate New York that was off the grid entirely, meaning it had an outhouse, and there was no electricity, and there was no running water, and there was no power, and there's none of those things that we consider modern amenities.
So just like kerosene lamps and candles and stuff?
It was kerosene lamps or candles. It was actually a lot of clocks in the house. So you're sitting there at night. My grandfather would be over in one corner next to the kerosene lamp reading a history book. My grandmother would be under the kerosene lamp. She'd be crocheting. And you'd hear the of about five clocks around the house that were either spring or weighted.
But hand-cranked.
Right. And I'd be sitting there with a stereopticon looking at another kerosene lamp of 3D pictures of the, pyramids of Chops or the Eiffel Tower. And we lived there with no power. I lived there in the summer when I was a kid. I went to my grandparents' place. So I spent 3 months, usually every year, from the early 50s until the late 40s until the early 50s, with no energy at all other than what was on the ground, so to speak.
So this is the 1950s or the 1850s?
Well, 1945 to 1953.
Okay, because, I mean, stereopticons kind of went out of style a while ago.
Not in upstate New York and Amish country in 1953. They were still quite popular.
Well, that's pretty cool that you were able to experience that as a child.
Yeah, the closest you might have experienced was a little Kodachrome snap things in a circle that had Donald Duck in 3D in color.
Yeah, like a ViewMaster.
Yeah, that's the same thing. But it was like the Stereopticon was the 19th century brand of that. But anyway, that was one experience I had that kind of prepared me for the idea that that could be a life.
All right, so this is something that you grew up and you had a reference or an anchor point.
Right, in early childhood. And
right.
My grandparents were totally comfortable because they had known it early in their life. And I became kind of comfortable with the idea because I experienced it in my early life with them.
Yeah, and you had probably good feelings and good memories about that, as opposed to, like, it wasn't fearful or...
No, it wasn't like, oh, my God, it's the end of the world. And it was like, I ain't going to curl up with, whatever, that's harsh in the adventure book or Adventures on Mars, curled up and reading. But the other experience I had, and I think you know about this, Jonathan, because I think we've talked about it, but in the early 1970s, I lived here, 1971 and 72, and I was homeless, and during that time, I never lived indoors. I didn't have a bathroom or power other than what the vehicle battery provided, and lived...
You went to the bathroom on the vehicle... I'm having a hard time following you.
No. I went to the bathroom in the county parks. I took a shower at the showers at the county parks.
That makes more sense.
And I parked in isolated places and turned on the radio and turned on the dome light in my Volkswagen bus and read and listened to music. And that was the extent of the electricity I had. And it was vitally important to me to be able to hear popular music in the middle of the darkness at night, or to be able to read a book by the 6-volt dome light of the Volkswagen 1964 bus. But again, it was a preparation for living with a lot less than I had lived when I was a teenager, or in Levittown, Long Island, or different times in my life when there was energy aplenty.
Right.
The experience I had in the bus taught me one thing, and that was that I couldn't just sit there at night and read and play the radio and expect to start the battery the next day and get to some place where I had to do some work.
Yeah, because you could actually power that battery down and drain it, and then you wouldn't be able to start your car in the morning.
Right. So what I did over a period of several months was buy 3 6-volt batteries and put them in a line with toggle switches on my dashboard so that I could isolate them. And I'd have one always charged up, ready for starting, and one as a backup, and then one for reading and playing around. So I could hit that last toggle switch and read all night and isolate it from the starting battery, and then in the morning have a fresh battery to start with. And that had a lot to do with how I designed the system I'm living with now, and that is isolated, separate systems that do different tasks that can lean on each other if required.
Well, what happened 6 years ago that you finally just started to work towards today, when you have been able to cut the cord with KIUC, pull the plug, no more wire going to your house?
One was that I was very distrustful of the failure of Kauai Electric back in the early days when I moved here, which I moved here in 2001, when KIUC was failing and it was in debt for $150 million, and there was this scheme essentially to create KIUC as a quote-unquote cooperative for a huge amount of money, incurring tremendous debt. I was very doubtful of that enterprise and didn't think it was going to work out well. That was one factor.
Okay. And what was your second factor?
Another factor was that in 2005, I read James Kunstler's book, The Long Emergency, and came to believe that there was imminent problems with energy costs, energy availability, financialization, a number of things that were going to lead to a collapse, which did occur in a few years after that. And that was about the time it sort of put a fire under me to look for more energy, water, food, and other kinds of independences from systems that could give me some autonomy and some insulation from vagaries of bad organizations doing stupid things.
So if someone listening right now thought, hey, that sounds interesting to me, I'm curious to know what I could do. What things have you learned? What lessons have you learned? And how would you do it differently now?
How would I do it differently, or how would I do it? I mean, that's two entirely different questions.
Well, I suppose you can answer the one that you prefer.
Okay. Well, what I found was that I didn't have enough money at the time to just say, well, I'm going to put a $30,000 or $40,000 solar system in my house and go off the grid. I could not do that because I didn't have the wherewithal to do that. So what I did was I tried to find the least expensive ways to answer some of what I thought would be immediate problems with the little money that I did have.
So you broke it into steps.
I broke it into, steps incrementally, starting with the smallest, and learning from that and stumbling and finding out that was a mistake and adding something or subtracting something. And what I found was that it was not too hard without a huge amount of mistakes being made to find some small, useful thing that could be done with the knowledge that I had to solve a problem. And an example would be you're laying there in the dark at night in your bedroom, you want to turn a light on, and you want to walk to the bathroom, turn a light on, and deal with a mosquito bite or whatever it is. But just that little bit of lighting in the middle of the night and solving that problem and not have to wonder whether the grid was on or not, that was a major milestone to me. And that was one of the first things I solved, so to speak. And another case was the under-counter lighting in the kitchen and the second bathroom and a little bit of energy for a radio and a light in the living room so you could listen to music, cook your dinner, go to the bathroom, go to bed without dealing with all the other problems that might be occurring.
So you broke it down into tiny parts, and you addressed them one at a time.
Right. So right now, as I said, I have six different systems on the roof that all do different things that are isolated and, as I say, can lean on each other in this sense. I have one system that's just dedicated to refrigeration and freezing. It's four 245-watt panels. They go to one controller and one inverter and eight batteries, and that's all they do. But if it's...
So like dedicated power for that.
Dedicated power for refrigeration, which is a huge part of what most people consume in terms of energy.
How did you isolate the different appliances on the little grid inside your house?
Well, it wasn't on the grid. These are off-grid. In other words, the refrigerator is plugged into a system that is totally isolated from everything else. And it's plugged into eight batteries that have an inverter on them and four panels, and those are sufficient for the freezer and the refrigerator to operate 24 hours a day under most circumstances. Now, if it's Thanksgiving Day and you've got four turkeys you're freezing or defrosting, or you got, under some loads, if it's cloudy for 3 days, I might have a problem with that the load that I would put on that refrigerator and freezer. Under those circumstances, because I've got six systems here, I can say, well, I'm going to offload the freezer onto this system. I'm going to offload that to that. And I can sort of, I won't turn on the computer today, but the whole system isn't going to go down because of this one pressure here.
So
if that makes any sense to you.
Yeah, well, it sounds to me like, again, you have to maintain an awareness to what's actually going on.
Right. Well, again, I would bring up that analogy of a sailboat versus a motorboat. On a sailboat, and I sailed when I was a kid. I haven't sailed for 40 years. But when I did sail, your attention to the horizon, the size of the waves, the angle of the wind, the current, all these things are pretty vital compared to when you have a speedboat and you're just crashing through the waves.
Yeah, with a steering wheel on it.
With a steering wheel and 450 horsepower mercury in the back.
Right.
When you're sailing a boat, it's just with the energy of the waves and the wind that are available, and therefore you have to be very sensitive to those things. So I look up in the sky at clouds during the day. I check the voltage on different systems. I see what's on and what's off in the house. It's like a tighter maintenance of all these things, which just in general makes me more aware of what's happening and able to control it.
Hmm.
And therefore, the systems I've built, although I wouldn't say they're minor in terms of the cost I've incurred, they're not like 50 panels on the roof or 32 panels on the roof. It's the equivalent of maybe 14 or 15, you know, medium-sized 24-volt panels. But they're broken down into these different systems. And that has, I think, been good for me. It's certainly not, I'm not co-generating. You know, it's funny, you know, when I called KAUC to get off the grid, to end the contract.
I cut the cord,
literally. I called up, you know, their number, and one of the first numbers on their system is like, disconnect. So I punch the button, and I think, what's her name, Chantel or something, answer the phone.
Some very nice person, no doubt.
She was very nice, and she was very serviceable. She was wonderful.
I find every time I call KAC, almost universally, the person who answers the phone is extremely nice and gracious.
And efficient and knowledgeable, all that was fine. So, I say, I'd like to do a disconnect. And she says, oh, okay, what's the address? What's your name? What's the account? Blah, blah, blah. And we go through that. And then I say, well, I'd like the meter taken off, of course. And then I'd also like the wire taken off the house. You know, I don't want the line on the house anymore.
Sure, no need.
So her response was, oh, you're going to demolish the house. And I said, au contraire.
Oh, you suddenly started speaking to her in French.
I'm sorry. I didn't actually say au contraire. I said, no, that's not the case.
Okay.
I'm not demolishing the house. It's quite the opposite. But that was, she couldn't think of a reason why I'd take the KUC wire off the house unless I was demolishing it.
Huh.
Which I thought was really fascinating. Maybe not to you, but anyway.
It hadn't occurred
to me I was going to demolish the house because I was taking the wire off.
Yeah, I was just reflecting on what you were saying. I wouldn't think that you'd be demolishing the house, not if you're going to live there with your solar panels on it.
Right. But she hadn't heard about the solar panels. She was just hearing about the disconnect.
Hmm.
So
maybe she had a disconnect with what you were really up to.
Right. The second detail of the KAC relationship was that when they did call it and they had a service guy come down, and I happen to know him, actually, because he grew up in the valley here, and he's a really nice guy. And he says, well, what do you want to do here? I said, yeah, I want it taken off, and I'm just, you know, disconnecting everything. And he's got his, articulated hydraulic rig, and he brings it into the yard, and, you know, he takes the meter off. He checks to see if the power's off already. I've disconnected the line. And so he said, oh, you're disconnecting, huh? I said, yep. And his response, which I thought was really interesting, was, good idea. And it's the KIUC service guy.
Well, let's not give him a name.
No, I'm not going to give him a name.
Yeah.
But he said, good idea.
That's awesome. Well, if somebody else thinks it's a good idea, what would be your recommendation to them for how they could start this process for themselves?
Well, it depends on if they're rich or not, really.
Well,
my
father always used to say, rich or poor, it's always better to have money. But
that's true, but most people don't. And I would say if you don't have a lot of money, you can't just pop for the tens of thousands of dollars. Don't go for the lease contract where they say, we'll lease your roof and we'll pay for a $40,000 system. You won't have to pay a dime. We're going to guarantee you never have to pay more than $150 a month. And blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, well, nobody gives something for nothing. So
right, and the thing they did when they leased that house is it's kind of in perpetuity. Like, you don't own those panels, and it's a weird deal. When you look at the contract details, they can raise the price later. You may be paying more than you thought you were going to pay. But you don't own that system, and your roof is no longer yours. You've leased the roof.
Okay, so that's what you recommend people not do. What would you recommend be a modest first step towards unplugging from the grid?
Starting with the smallest step, and the smallest step would be to look at your resources and what you're willing to sacrifice to learn something. And I would say under $1,000 would be a good starting point, but, you know, not a whole lot less. I mean, between $600 and $1,000.
So what would you – so you have $1,000.
Yeah,
what would you recommend to be done with
that? A solar panel of some size, and we could talk about the details of that. You buy a solar panel. You buy a small controller. They would at least handle that one solar panel. You'd buy a couple of batteries that would support something you might want to power. And you'd buy an inverter that was appropriate in size for that to create AC power. And from that, you would run a laptop computer in the light at night, or you'd run something that was a critical thing to you that if everything else went out in the middle of the night, you'd say, hey, I've got this little nightlight, I've got my computer, whatever it is you think are critical small tasks. And if you can solve those, you're on your way to solving all the problems.
Do you have an online resource that you could point people to that's been helpful to you in taking your steps to energy independence?
Well, yeah, I'd say I wrote an article today, actually, on my blog, islandbreath.org, which is called Kicking the KAC Habit, and it goes more or less through a history of my personal experience and what the costs were to get to energy independence of the KAC where you could cut them off. Okay, and, you know, the bottom line for me, and it would be less now for someone else probably, but the bottom line for me was, go to the bottom of the list here. It looks like it's $23,690, something like that.
And that was over a period of 6 years.
That was a period of several years, right. And the last hit was like $12,700, but that's what took the breaker box and the whole load center off the grid. All the outlets in the house are running, all the switches, all the lighting and everything else, except for my toaster oven and my big microwave. But everything else is working, including my power tools in the garage and everything else.
If you're just tuning in, this is Out of the Box with Dave Giroux and myself, Jonathan Jay, here on KKCR. We're talking with Juan Wilson, and he's been explaining just exactly how it is that he was able to take the steps to cut the cord and pull the plug and get off the grid from KIUC here on Kauai.
Right. And one of the things I would caution people is that if they go through all these steps, it depends on what age you are, where you are in your life, and other things in terms of how you would deal with the consequences of.
Uh-oh, are you still there, Juan?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, keep going.
Okay. If you are going to try this, you have to realize that such things as your 400 amp hour 6 volt batteries in that array that you spent $5,000 for aren't going to be running in 5 or 8 or whatever 7 years, even if you maintain them well. But if you draw them down every day as you go through the cycle of your life, they'll lose 1 amp hour to the 3,200 amp hours they've got every day, and somewhere downstream you're not going to be able to do what you're doing now. And you may find 5 or 7 years from now, depending on the world situation, the world financial conditions, that you can't replace those batteries because you can't afford them, or they're not available and they can't be fixed.
Yeah, well, batteries are an issue.
They are the issue, ultimately, in a sense, because other parts, like the photovoltaic panels, they'll last 30 years. They'll probably outlast you.
Right. Well, I was talking with a friend of mine who invested in something called nickel iron batteries, which I guess have a much longer life cycle than your lead acid batteries.
Well, these aren't lead acid. The one I'm talking about are glass mat. They're AGMs, which are a sealed battery that has longer lasting capabilities than the old lead acid that you got to maintain the liquids in and have gases coming off of them. But the AGM batteries are better, but they're not. There's no end all be all for the batteries. The batteries, like your body, take a beating over time, and that's going to be the weak link ultimately. But you may be reduced to doing your laundry only during daylight hours, if you know what I mean.
Sure, when the sunlight's streaming.
When the sunlight's shining and you still have a couple of hundred amp hours left in your batteries.
Well, it's funny. People kind of complain about that, but I'm perfectly happy to do stuff in the daytime, like be awake, and I'm perfectly happy
right.
to do stuff
exactly.
at night, like
That's
sleep.
How we were designed.
Yeah, so I don't feel the personal need to be able to do anything I want in any moment, in any time, forever.
Well, If it's keeping the food frozen in the freezer, that might be an issue. So anyway, the battery thing is an issue, but I think what the whole one of the conclusions I've made of this whole arc of experience is that it's really acclimating me to eventually living on this island like people did in the past. That is, I'll just use less and less energy over time, but it won't be a tremendously sheer catastrophic drop when oil prices hit $200 a gallon or KUC isn't functional anymore or whatever. I've got some independence and resilience that can take me quite a ways coasting along before I have to deal with just, you know, living in Hawaii like the Hawaiians live.
Well, you know, I think this is something that for you is going to continue on, and maybe we can check back in with you in 6 months or a year or so and see what's changed, what you've learned, or how things have continued to evolve.
Yeah, well, I hope that's true.
Yeah, I want to thank you for calling in, Juan, and sharing your experiences about cutting the cord with KIUC. And is there any kind of closing comment that you'd like to leave the listener with?
The more resilience and independence you develop yourself, the more autonomous and the better off you're going to be, in a sense. So learn it yourself. Don't hire somebody to do this. Learn it yourself.
All right. Well, thanks so much. I think that that's kind of self-empowering, too, yeah?
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah. All right. Well, good luck with that.
Thanks. You come visit soon, I hope.
Justin. Okay. All right. Well, I will stop by on the south side.
All righty.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Okay, well, we got about 5 or 6 minutes left on this show. If anybody wants to call in, phone lines are open at 826-7771.
Did you want to talk about the Office of Environmental Quality?
Let's see what's on the phone here first. Then we do have a caller.
Aloha, caller, you're on the air.
You know how I get electricity and lighting and stuff is I conjure up ghosts and demons, and they work for me.
Go and conjure up demons with a flashlight.
Yeah, exactly. You know, whenever I need to rattle some change, you know, I just do some conjuring, you know.
Like little tiny electrons?
Yeah, you know, I get little bolts of shocks, you know, from the spirit world.
Well,
anyways,
if you can maintain those connections, that's awesome.
I think all we really need to solve all our problems is arrest more nonviolent drug offenders.
I'm pretty sure you don't really mean that.
You know, when somebody was talking about the price for incarceration,
uh-huh.
It's like $50,000 a year for an adult, $200,000 a year for a juvenile.
Yeah.
And you just go, because people, you know, they're already, they want to turn in their local drug dealers, but do they want to pay for the incarceration, you know?
Well, I've always thought it was kind of nuts because you could send these kids to Harvard and it would be cheaper.
Exactly.
And then they would be like an asset to the community.
Yeah, give them a round-the-world airplane ticket with hotel, with accommodations to kind of see the world and, you know.
Sure, and come back the wiser.
Yeah, exactly, you know, but you know, one thing that somebody said on Felicia's show, you know, who was talking about, you know, they know who the big crystal meth amphetamine dealer is in Kilauea, and Felicia was very innocently says, well, I don't know. And I don't know either, except it's your mother, it's your father, it's your son, it's your daughter, it's your aunt and your uncle.
Well, that's
who it is.
It's got to be somebody who lives here because it's only us. It's a community.
Well, yeah, you know, and basically it becomes personal. Take responsibility for your own actions, you know, and the ultimate. And if it's a juvenile offender, if they're going to cart them off to jail, you know, they should take the parents along with them. I don't know. You know, I'm a totally.
Do you have any kids?
What's that?
Do you have children?
Well, I have an extended family. Let me put it that way. I'm a child. I have parents, right?
Okay.
That I'm lucky are still living. But you know, kids will break rules no matter how good the parents are. I mean, it's just bound to happen. You know, but you know, tolerance is the key to, you know, because I mean, there's just way too many people in prison. You know,
yeah, we talked about that earlier.
That'll save the overtime. It just came out Kauai spends more overtime than anybody on police.
Yeah, you know, I think it was over three.
A little less arresting for drug offenses. It's a medical issue. It's not a judicial issue, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, we're never going to solve it that way.
Yeah, and if you want to get hooked, if you can afford it, I mean, you have a right to do with what's your body, with what you want, even though they'd like to tell you that, oh, no, don't do drugs, drink Budweiser, you know? and I'm not advocating drug
the drinking
use.
Of Budweiser. No, I understand
I'm
that.
I'm advocating good health. I mean, we should all treasure our health, you know, but you know, we ultimately make our own personal decisions, you know, along with our parents if we're juveniles, you know. But anyways, have a great day.
Okay, thank you, caller.
Okay, well, that's nearly the show right there. I got 2 minutes. Let's see. Oh, there was a story that I am following. That I haven't gotten a resolution on this, but there was a person, Jessica Woolley. This is somebody.
A Hawaii State Legislator.
Hawaii State Representative.
Yeah.
And she was nominated to be the Director of State Office of Environmental Quality Control. This is an office that Gary Hoeser held a few years back. When he left to run for county council in 2012, this article in the Honolulu Star Advertisers mentioned that Gary Hoeser often bristled by what he saw as the administration's attempt to rein in his environmental advocacy. And Jessica Woolley is obviously evidently an environmentalist. And sounds like it would be good qualifications to be in this position here. But she's kind of been butting heads with this other representative, Nishihara, who is in the Senate Agricultural Committee. And according to this article, she is a moderate, but she's against labeling food with genetically modified organisms and is in favor of the right to farm protections for modern agriculture, including biotechnology. And Woolley is a progressive and leader of the movement against GMOs. When I guess being environmentalist and being against GMOs, it does not qualify you or disqualifies you from holding state offices like the environmental quality control position. And so the hearing was supposed to be today, and a lot of the environmental groups are pushing to have her nominated here. I think there was supposed to be a hearing today, but I never saw any resolution on that. So I'm not sure what's going on with that.
Well, the election season is coming soon upon us, and I think perhaps in some of our next shows we'll talk about who's running for what. But we've got a list that I pulled down off of the state archive, and just to let you know, there's three or four people have already filed to run for mayor in addition to Mayor Bernard Carvalho. So he has some people signing up to run against him. And also it seems like there's a growing list of people who have pulled their papers for the county council race. And I scanned down through there, and I was surprised to see the name Daryl Perry on that list. So evidently our present chief of police here for Kauai is contemplating a run for the county council. And I think we can look forward to future shows where we perhaps talk with him about what it is he'd like to do as county council member, and as well as interviewing other folks running for office. So
I wonder, would he have to step down as police chief if he were on the county council? Would that be a conflict?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer.
He would be his own boss if that were the case.
That's a good position to hold if he can pull it off.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that, Dave. It seems like he certainly should have to step down, but perhaps that could be a question that we ask him in the future.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it is 6 o'clock. We need to get off the air and open up the phone or open up the board here to the Acoustic Luau with Marin. So enjoy the show, and we'll be back in a couple weeks here.
Hey, thanks so much, everybody. Aloha, ahui ho, and malama pono.